The Lord be with you. Jesus said to his disciples, I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth, so that when it is gone, they will welcome you into the eternal homes. All right, let's talk about wealth. Let's talk about the wealth of nations. In 1545, in what is now Bolivia, Spaniards discovered that there was a mountain called Potosí, and this mountain was a literal mountain of silver. Over the next 50 years, the silver extracted from Potosí would double the amount of silver in circulation in the entire world. Now, in the mid-18th century, when the United States or the 13 colonies that would become the United States were gearing to declare their independence from Britain, the country of Brazil had discovered gold and diamonds and was exporting to Portugal wealth worth more than double what the 13 British colonies were producing. And yet today, Brazil has a GDP 10 times less than that of the United States, despite having geography of about the same size. Bolivia has a GDP 500 times less than that of the United States. But the poverty rates are even more striking. According to the World Bank, the percentage of people in Brazil living under $2 a day now is down to 4%, but 20 years ago was at 12%. And 20 years ago in Bolivia, the number of people living under $2 a day was 59%. These places of incredible wealth became places of incredible poverty. What happened? Now, for me, this is not just an academic question, this is a personal question. My mother is from Mexico, my grandparents still live there, and my whole life I have often pondered the difference between the cultures that I have inherited. Now, my parents, my dad and my stepmom live in Milton Freewater, Oregon, and they have a lovely home, and their lovely home has no fence around it. And they like to sit out in the lawn and wave to their neighbors who walk by, and they turn their backyard into a community garden, and they rarely lock their home. Now, when I go to Mexico to visit my grandparents have about the same standard of living as my parents do. Their home is completely walled off. It's always locked. And on top of the wall, they have broken shards of glass cemented on top of that wall. And above the cemented broken shards of glass, there is electric wires. And I have often thought to myself, why is there that difference in culture? Why is there this difference in wealth and this fear of neighbors? Now, as I've thought about this, there are two books in particular that have shaped my thinking. On the next slide here, I've got them. The first one is 1493 by Charles Mann. It was written in 2012. And Charles Mann is an American, a journalist, and he has won several academic and scientific awards for his books looking at the Americas both before and after the arrival of Europeans. And the second book is called The Open Veins of Latin America by Eduardo Galeano. And Galeano is from Uruguay, and he wrote this book in 1971, and when he wrote this book, he was angry. He was angry because he saw the poverty in his own country and the poverty throughout Latin America, and he looked north to the United States, and he said, how is it that both the United States and Latin America started off as colonies of Europe, colonies that, you know, eradicated the indigenous people, brought in slaves, and yet one of these colonies has become wealthy and prosperous, and these other colonies have become poor? And he wanted to understand why. And between these two authors, I have some thoughts that I think will help us understand the gospel lesson today and the parable that Jesus tells us about the unjust steward. So we can go ahead and take that slide down. To say, Galeano says, the people of Latin America are poor because their land is rich. Let me say that again. The people of Latin America are poor because their land is rich. And what he means by this is that when Spaniards and Portuguese discovered immense wealth in South America, what they figured out was how to take the wealth as quickly out of South America and take it to Europe, right? When Spaniards discovered a mountain of silver in Potosí, they didn't say to themselves, ah, well, let's come and bring our families and set up schools and hospitals and have a nice life here at Potosí. They said, no, let's bring in a bunch of slaves, as few Europeans as possible to manage those slaves, and see how quickly we can get the wealth out of this mountain and take it back to Spain. And if I own some of that wealth, you better believe I'm not going to hang out in Potosí. That's a crummy town to live in. I'm going to go hang out in Madrid and spend all the money I've made there. And the same thing in Brazil. They said, oh, we found gold, we found diamonds, we got sugar plantations. Well, the Europeans didn't want to live there. They said, all we need are slaves and a few people to manage it, and we can extract the wealth, put it on a boat, send it to Europe, and we can spend the money there. Now, the difference is, here in the 13 British colonies, those 13 British colonies had much less access to valuable natural resources. At the best, in the South, in the Carolinas and Virginias, they could grow tobacco. But I will tell you, tobacco as a cash crop pales in comparison to sugar, and especially pales in comparison to just pulling out a mountain of silver. And further north in the 13 colonies, you get in the mid-Atlantic states, sure, they could grow food, grain, but wheat isn't a cash crop. And further north, you get into New England. What they got there? They got rocks. They got rocks, and they got fish. And so they began to build boats. And it's important to realize that in Latin America and in other British colonies in the Caribbean, when the European powers figured out that there was one good there that they could extract and send back to Europe, they made a point to say, okay, nothing else should be developed in this place. They wanted to make sure there was no manufacturing and no industry so that the people who mined the goods from the Americas had to then buy manufactured products from Europe so that the European industry develop factories and a burgeoning middle class there. To the extent that there were literally laws, in Haiti, it was illegal to create a single bobby pin because they wanted the Haitians to buy everything from France. Now, England had these same rules for the 13 British colonies, but essentially the 13 British colonies didn't make enough money for the British to care about them. And so they didn't bother patrolling, they didn't bother making sure that the colonists in North America were following the rules. And what that meant is, over time, New England could build boats. They could build boats and use that to ship goods across the Atlantic to gather wealth. It meant that over time, the North could develop industry, could develop cotton mills, so that the southern plantations would have a market to send their goods to other than to just Europe. And what that meant is, when time for independence came, the 13 colonies of these now United States said to themselves, let's work together. Because the southern states can create cash crops and raw goods, the northern states can create manufacturing to use and ship those goods, and the mid-Atlantic states can grow the food to feed everyone. We can work together and make a prosperous nation. But in Latin America, each country was basically exporting the same good to Europe. And so each port said, wait, why should Buenos Aires work with Lima? They're just our competitors. They're doing the same thing we did. And so instead of having United States of South America, you had a huge fragmentation of vying states that went to war with each other. Now, when the United States declared independence, because the wealth was so limited as to what could be extracted here in the North, it meant that the colonies in the North America couldn't just pay managers to manage their states and go party with the riches in Europe. They had to stay here themselves. They had to stay here themselves and oversee their industry. In the North, Northern colonies, they farmed themselves, fished themselves. And what that meant was they had to live here full-time. And because they lived here full-time, they said to themselves, well, okay, we're generating some surplus from this land. What are we going to do with it? Are we going to spend it in Europe? No, they said, if I'm going to live here, I want there to be a school for my child to be educated in. If I'm going to live here, I want there to be a hospital so that when I get sick, there are doctors to take care of me. They said, if I'm going to live here, I want to build colleges and roads so that I can have a better quality of life in this country rather than going back to Europe. When the United States declared independence, it had 9 colleges. When Mexico declared independence, and keep in mind, at this point in history, Mexico is several times larger than the 13 colonies and has more people in it. Compared to the United States' 9 colleges, Mexico had 3. French Guiana didn't have a college until 1966, and it's no coincidence that the French never established a successful European city in French Guiana. And so they didn't care enough to invest in the infrastructure. Now, what that meant is, when the people who created the revolutions in each of these countries became the new ruling class, they had very different opinions about what to do with the countries that they were in charge of. Here in the United States, the ruling class, they definitely wanted their money, but they wanted to make sure that their money built themselves cities that were worth living in. Where in Latin America, they wanted their money, and then they wanted to get the heck out of town and go over to Europe and spend their money there. And so we see, even in the development of the interior of the continent into the 19th century, the political leaders of each region came up with very different perspectives of how to do this. In Latin America, the political leaders said, how much money can we get from the land? And so they would sell massive land grants called haciendas to big plantation owners, plantations that would have over 500,000 acres dedicated to just growing one crop and all the profits going to one person. Here in the United States, we came up with something called the Homestead Act of 1862. And what the Homestead Act said is that anyone who was willing to work the land, who was over 21 years of age, be they black or white, be they male or female, was able to get 160 acres. And the difference is, the haciendas generated a handful of people with immense wealth, whereas the Homestead Act generated hundreds of thousands of people with modest wealth. And what that meant was, those hundreds of thousands of people with modest wealth, they would have a little bit of surplus. And so they would say to themselves, you know what? I see my neighbors could really use this product. Let me build it and sell it to them. And they had someone to buy their product. The hacienda owners in Latin America, they would continue producing coffee or sugar or gold, but they had no one in their own country to sell it to because everyone else was so poor that the only market available to them was to Europe. And so that system of mercantilism, of taking raw goods from one country and sending them to Europe and buying expensive finished goods back from Europe, that continued well into the 20th century. The result is 2 different perspectives on how to use the wealth of a nation. One is to say, how much wealth can I extract from the land and then get the heck out of here? And the other one said, with the wealth that I have extracted from the land, how can I invest it? So it's not just the land that I'm extracting wealth from, but that the people of the land become prosperous together, and together we create an economy that lasts. Okay, why do I bring this all up? I bring this all up because today's lesson is a continuation of last week's lesson, when the Pharisees, the religious leaders, are complaining that Jesus is hanging out with people who aren't worth anything, sinners and tax collectors. And Jesus says, you think these people I'm hanging out with aren't worth anything? Well, let me tell you a story. And Jesus tells them a story of a rich man who has a manager. Perhaps we can imagine the rich man is the owner of a large hacienda. And he doesn't want to live on the hacienda. He wants to go live in the big city. And so he has a manager to take care of it for him. And the manager does. And the manager's job is to make sure that all the little farmers who work the land of the hacienda produce the number of goods that they're supposed to each year to give to the rich owner. But the rich owner has heard that this manager is squandering his wealth. And so the owner comes to the manager and says, give me an accounting of your management because you're fired. And so the manager realizes he's out of a job, and he says, okay, if I don't have a job, my manager's not going to let me take the wealth with me. He says, what options do I have? Well, I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. He goes, oh, I got a plan. I'll make people like me so that they welcome me into their homes when I don't have a job. And so what he does is he goes to those farmers who work on the hacienda, who work for the rich man, and he says to them, how much do you owe? And the first guy says, I owe 100 jugs of olive oil. That's how much I'm supposed to give to the rich man this year from the land. And the manager says, cut it in half, make it 50. And to the next guy, he goes, and how many containers of wheat do you owe? And the guy says, well, I owe 100 containers of wheat. And the manager says, make it 80 containers of wheat. Now, what's curious about this story is that at the end of it, the rich man sees what the manager has done and commends him for it. Says, good job, you did the right thing. Wait, the manager did the right thing by shorting his boss 50% of all the income that he was supposed to get, 20% of all the income he was supposed to get? Like, why? And then what's even more puzzling is Jesus says to his disciples, I say to you, make friends for yourselves by means of dishonest wealth so that when it is gone, they may welcome you into the eternal homes. But it starts to make sense if we understand, one, this idea of extracting wealth from nations versus reinvesting wealth in nations. And two, we understand that the owner of this estate is God, and that each and every one of us is a manager. Because the truth is, each and every one of us has been given a little piece of wealth of this world. And that little piece might just be our own lives, but to say everything in the universe belongs to God, and God has given us just one little bit of it to manage. Now the question is, what does it mean to properly manage what God has given us? It could be that our job is to extract all the possible wealth we can from our life and from this world and give it to God. I don't know, maybe there's like a rainbow or something and we like put a crate of gold on it and it shoots up to heaven. No, obviously, right, that's not what we're supposed to do. But it's worth saying because there are religions, right? The Vikings thought their goal in life was to amass as big a hoard as possible and bury it in the ground where no one could find it, because when they were dead, they would get to spend the money in the afterlife. That is not our theology, right? There are no U-Hauls following hearses. You don't get to take it with you. To say, okay, if our goal in life is clearly not to get God as much gold as possible, what are we supposed to do with the wealth that God has given us to manage? Now, the manager has figured out that his strategy of extracting wealth is not working. God has come and is making a reckoning for him. And I tell you, for each and every one of us, a reckoning will come when God asks for an account of how we use the money. And I will tell you, hoarding up a pile of cash is not going to be helpful in that moment. And so the manager realizes he's got to figure out another plan. Now, one of the common plans in Latin America would be, okay, you're losing your job, but you're still managing the hacienda for another day or something. Just take as much wealth as you can and run off to another city and just use the wealth to live as well as you can while you got it. But the manager doesn't do that. Instead of taking his final day to extract every last penny he can, he uses his final day to invest the wealth that he manages back into his own community. He goes to the farmers and says, reduce your bill. He doesn't absolve them completely, but he lowers what they owe. And by doing this, he does a few things. One, he does his job. He manages the wealth that he is supposed to manage in the same way that each of us have a job, and each of us have a job that requires, you know, we make money for our boss on some level. But he also builds bonds of trust. He builds bonds of trust because he has let the people who work for him know that they matter more than just wealth. And because he has done this in the name of his boss, he's built bonds of trust not just between himself and those workers. He's built bonds of trust between his boss and those workers. Which is to say, if God is our manager, he has used the wealth that God has given him to help people not only trust in the relationship he has with them, but to trust in their relationship with God. Look, we may not have a hacienda to run, but we have been given a small piece of this world to manage. And we have a choice on how we want to manage it. We have a choice to manage it either by extracting every last resource we can from our own lives and from the lives of the people around us. And sometimes, yes, that might be in the form of wealth, but sometimes that might be in the form of status. Sometimes that might be in the form of favors. We have a choice to do that. And if we do that, we end up living in a world in which we need to build walls with broken glass on top of them, covered with electric fences, because people know that our relationship with everyone else is that of a competitor, and we are here to get what we can until we can skip town. And we have another option. The other option is to look around with this life in which we have been given, with the people in our lives, with the skills that we possess, and to say we can use what we have been given to build up the people around us, to build up our neighborhoods and our communities so that we can go and sit in our backyard without need for fences, because each person who walks by knows that their life and our life are connected and that what benefits us will benefit them. And to say we have a choice to how we can live in this life. We can choose to live in a society with broken glass walls or in a society in which there are schools and hospitals for everyone. But the trick is, what Jesus tells us is, if we have been faithful in little, we get to be faithful in much. And if we have been faithful with what God has entrusted us that does not belong to us, God is faithful. God will entrust to us what belongs to us. Which is to say, the reality that we create here on earth becomes our reality for eternity. To say, if we create for ourselves a reality on this earth in which we are afraid of our neighbors and hide behind broken glass because we have squeezed them for every penny, we will find ourselves in an eternity hiding behind broken glass, scared for eternity. And if instead we create for ourselves a society in which we rejoice because we have invested in each other and because the other person's gain is our gain, we get to spend our lives in an eternity in which we look around and rejoice in the neighborhood of friends that we get to greet who have welcomed us into their eternal home. And so I say to you, with however much you have been given, be faithful, so that you may be faithful with eternity. Amen.